radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
Rest, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given right, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. It's afternoon for me, morning for most of the people listening, I think. Just after 4 p.m. in the UK, here on a Saturday afternoon. It's the 4th of February, I think. Struggling to keep pace with the year, but we're a month into it. And the sun's starting to come back, so I'm happy now. I struggle when it's dark at 4 o'clock. So I really struggle. So we're getting a little bit of light back, and that means my life's coming back. I'm starting to want to go out again. And we were, in theory, going to be getting a cold snap, but it hasn't happened so far, so it may be that we get some more cold weather coming in next week. I don't know. I'm not really keeping up with it. It takes me all my time to just keep up with what's in front of me, let alone 4 or 5 days ahead. So you're listening to Free Association. This is Revolution Radio, which is listener supported. We're grateful for any donations. And you can find a place to make a donation, if you so desire, at revolution.radio, either as a one-off or as a monthly thing. Everything helps. We're all volunteers, so literally everything does help. Keep the server running, keeps all the technology up to speed. And I don't have anything really planned at the moment. I could play a couple of videos probably, but I was sitting around yesterday trying to come up with a monologue, and I couldn't come up with anything. So I'm just going to make it up as I go along. But the show's called Free Association for a reason, because most of the time I am literally making it up as I go along. That's no bad thing. Sometimes a good combination of stuff can arrive without it being planned, and I'm hoping today's show is one of those. So I might need some help from the chat room if there's anybody listening. I know we've got Comet and Fleester in there. And a couple of other people. So if anybody's got any suggestions for a topic for the show, I'll just literally do a bit of searching and come up with a 10 or 15 minute video and then have a conversation about it. I've been watching old movies the last week or so, mostly Sherlock Holmes, the old Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes movies. And then I've just started on, I found a live stream of old episodes of The Addams Family. So I may potentially play a little bit of that just to see how it's going. It was Morticia and the Psychiatrist, I think, the one that was playing when I left it. So that'll be going on for about another 10 minutes, and then it'll be a new episode. So we may well join a live stream of the Addams Family in 10 minutes if I can't come up with anything else to do. All right, let's have a quick look on BitChute on the entertainment category. That always is a good place to start. People forget that there's entertainment on BitChute because it's mostly horrendous end of the world stuff. But there is some potential for old movies. The Tin Star has just been uploaded. Cowboy movie from 1957. Dark Star has just been uploaded, which is a science fiction movie from 1974, which I quite like. Seen it many times. An episode of I Love Lucy. What else have we got? The Avenger. The Mysterious Traveller. Charlie Chan. All right, The Time Machine. It's 26 minutes, The Time Machine. I don't know how they can manage to get it into 26 minutes, but somebody's managed. 39 Steps, this is a radio drama. Some old episodes of Airwolf on there as well. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll do a little bit of that. Well, we'll do all of that Time Machine radio drama. Let's have a look at it. If I can find it again. There we go. Let's see what this is. This will keep us going for 25 minutes. Let me share my screen.
Airplanes shattering speed records, racing on ahead of the sound of their own engines. We can travel almost anywhere in a matter of hours. But however fast we go, we never quite reach tomorrow. Tomorrow is always a day ahead of us. This seemed to vex Mr. H.G. Wells, so he wrote a story about a man who invented the sort of radioactive motorcycle, which would travel to tomorrow and into the future beyond. He called it The Time Machine. And the old professor, Kay Kaiser, chose it as his favorite story. Here's Act One. I shall call him the Time Traveler, for that's surely the best name for him. Of course, he has a name like other men, but it doesn't suit him. For it's an ordinary name, and the Time Traveler is... I shall always treasure the evenings I've spent at the home of the Time Traveler. It's his habit to invite three of us to dinner, perhaps once each fortnight. Famous London editor, a prominent artist, and myself as the representative of that world within our world, the theatre. Conversing with the Time Traveller was like dueling with a great fencing master. We'd all sit about lazily before the fire and admire his earnestness and the brilliance of his imagination.
Oh, come now, old fellow. You don't expect us to go.
I refuse to believe it.
Just a moment, please. I beg you to bear with me on this concept.
Oh, you're a dreamer.
This is pure dream stuff you're giving us.
Perhaps we're all dreaming, gentlemen. Was it Voltaire who said, "Last night I dreamed I was a butterfly. But how do I know that I am not now a butterfly, dreaming that I'm a man?"
I believe that the things which are solid and which can be seen and felt exist.
You do? Tell me then, what qualities do you feel are necessary to prove a thing exists?
Well, there are only three dimensions: length, breadth, thickness.
I object. I ask you to imagine, gentlemen, a cube. A square box, let us say, which has only those three dimensions: length, breadth, and thickness. Could you see it?
Of course. Why not?
Would not such a cube require another dimension?
Hmm?
It must also have duration.
Duration?
A cube or a box cannot exist instantaneously. It must last. It must have a fourth dimension, time. Anything in order to exist must have four dimensions: length, breadth, thickness, and duration. I've been working on a little invention.
Hardly new.
It isn't quite finished yet, but I think it may be ready for a demonstration, gentlemen. It's over here in my glass, please. Take a look at this, my friends. Not much larger than an ordinary alarm clock, you might say, but quite a remarkable little device.
Complicated. What is it?
This is a gadget for traveling along the dimension known as time.
What? Along the dimension of time?
Look at it this way, gentlemen. Thus far, we of the human race have only submitted to time. We've all drifted along with it together like a Huckleberry Finn floating down the Mississippi River on a raft. Time is very much like a river, you know. And suppose some very ingenious person, such as one of us, perhaps, should invent a machine which would travel upstream to the very headwaters of time itself, or race on ahead of the current to those parts of the time dimension which we call the future.
Oh, absurd. It's against all reason.
Shall I demonstrate?
With that gadget you have in your hand?
Pardon me, my friends, while I make some adjustments in the mechanism here. We might call this a time machine. Now observe. Here is one little white lever, and here is another.
It's beautifully made.
It took 2 years to complete. Now, I want you clearly to understand that this lever, being pressed over, sends the machine gliding into the future. And this other lever, so, reverses the motion. This saddle, in miniature, represents the seat of a time traveler. In a moment now, I shall press the lever, and off the machine will go. It will vanish, pass into future time, and disappear. Have a good look at the thing. Satisfy yourselves that there's no trickery.
There doesn't seem to be any trickery about it. No, everything seems perfectly legitimate and in order.
Very well, then. Watch.
The time traveler touched the little ivory lever on the machine. I'm sure not one eye blinked. Not one of us took his gaze off that fine clock-like mechanism resting on the library table. Slowly, the time traveler moved the lever. And there came a breath of wind. One of the candles on the mantel was blown out, and the little machine suddenly swung around, became indistinct, was seen as a ghost for a second perhaps. And it was gone. Vanished. Save for the lamp, the table was bare.
What happened?
Well, what do you make of it?
Are you trying to tell us that that machine has gone off into the future and it will never be seen again?
Since there's no one to press the other lever and reverse the motion, I predict that the machine will travel on indefinitely into the future. I have in my laboratory a nearly completed full-size time machine which can carry a living human being within its field of motion.
A living being?
Yes. And very shortly, I expect to step into the saddle of this mechanism and go for a few 100,000 years spin into the future.
You're not serious.
I've almost finished work on a machine in which I intend to explore time. Is that plain? I was never more serious in my life. If you gentlemen would have the goodness to join me at dinner exactly 1 week from tonight, I may have some astounding experiences to tell you
of my explorations in time.
Of course, the editor and the painter and I were at the home of the time traveler the following week. But there was no sign of our host, except a rather strange note which we found under the mantelpiece clock, asking us to begin dinner at 7 o'clock if, for any reason, he hadn't arrived. And so it was, we went to dinner without him. We were quite worried when, as we were finishing our dessert, our friend hadn't yet appeared. Then, I suddenly noticed that the door to the corridor outside the dining room was opening. Slowly, without noise. When the door opened wider, I saw the time traveler standing before us. His coat was dirty, his hair was mussed, and grayer, either with dust or because its color had actually faded. The face of our host was ghastly pale. For a moment, he hesitated in the doorway, as if he'd been dazzled by the light. And then he came into the room, walking with a footsore limp.
Good heavens, man. What's the matter?
What's happened to you?
We started dinner, as you suggested.
I'm glad you did. Don't let me disturb you. I'm quite all right. I've had a rather grim experience. I feel strange.
Here, come on, sit down.
I'll be all right in a minute. Save me some of that mutton, will you? I'm starving for a bit of meat.
Can you tell us where you've been?
I don't mind telling you what has happened, but I can't argue. I'm too tired.
Very well. We won't interrupt you.
Well, I didn't get the time machine ready to operate until this morning. Ask Cook to bring some more potatoes and gravy, will you please?
Yes,
really, I'm famished.
All right, so that's the first 10 minutes of it anyway. That's the time machine version from 1949. Of course, it was written many, many years before that by H.G. Wells. Let's have a look at what else is on BitChute today. We'll just do the whole show as extracts of things from BitChute. So we've got a little bit of, I've got Jeffrey Sachs. So this is Jeffrey Sachs from December, but he's talking about this earlier on, so I might as well.
I think for as long as I remember, and this now is quite several decades, at least for 55 years of my political memory, the U.S. has been at war almost nonstop. And this goes with the territory, and we're at war again, because the war in Ukraine is a U.S. war with Russia, in which Ukraine is the territory. Ukrainians are dying, Americans are fighting, funding, and defining the war aims. So this goes back a long time. My political life began marching on the streets of Detroit, Michigan against the Vietnam War. My political awareness began with the Pentagon Papers, which explained that American leaders lied repeatedly about the war, mainly to get to the next election. And Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, wrote a wonderful essay in 1970, which has stuck with me for 52 years, where he said the quagmire myth and the stalemate machine. And he was trying to explain why the U.S. was stuck in Vietnam. And he said that the usual expression is we walked into a quagmire. And he said, that is not the right model. The right model is what he called the stalemate machine, which is never admit defeat before the next election. But since there's always a next election, you never have the opportunity to admit defeat. It was only with Richard Nixon's impeachment that actually Gerald Ford was able to end the war in Vietnam. Otherwise, it would probably have gone on for another 50 years if it had been continuous presidential administrations. We specialize in perpetual war for two reasons. One, the wars are almost always a mistake because they are an attempt to address political issues through military means in a completely flawed way. And then once in, they can't be stopped almost without exception, or at least until 15 or 20 years has led to exhaustion. So we were in Afghanistan for 20 full years from 2001 to 2021. Biden used his first year to pull out of Afghanistan. I thought maybe there would be a year of peace, but that was a little naive on my part, because instead of negotiating with Putin at the end of 2021 over very pertinent issues like the enlargement of NATO to Ukraine, which is the main casus belli of this war, Biden said, I will not negotiate. And so we find ourselves back at war once again. I find all of this deeply disturbing, but am extraordinarily worried that we are about to enter more war in Asia, because we are actually in two fronts now. One is the war in Ukraine, which continues to threaten to expand, because, again, the model now is never allow defeat. If anything is on that path, escalate, which is not good when it's two nuclear superpowers. That's a pretty dangerous logic, but that is the prevailing logic. And if you criticize it, you're called a Putin apologist, which I am not, I want to say right at the beginning. I am nobody's apologist. I just don't like perpetual wars and think that we ought to use other means to resolve these issues. But the United States doctrine, unfortunately, is now rather explicit, and that is that to be secure, the U.S. must be the predominant power in each region of the world. So I liken it to a game that I played when I was young called Risk, which is a board game where the aim of the game is to have your piece on every part of the world map. And if you have your pieces on all but a few parts of the map, those places where you don't control could win back the territory that you have. So you're trying to have every piece on the board. Well, the United States has military bases in 80 countries around the world. But alas, for the United States, there are 193 countries, so there's a lot of wars to go. Because every place where we have a base, but there isn't a base next door, Americans feel a threat, and or we're told to feel a threat. And moreover, of course, and the deeper point is, China is now perceived by the United States as an existential threat to American primacy, because American policymakers cannot understand how we made the mistake of letting China become a powerful country. This was not in the playbook. China was supposed to develop in a way that is subservient to the United States. And so now we call it a failure that we made various mistakes, like letting China in the World Trade Organization or letting China play institutionally. This is obviously a mistake. Not, in my view, because China did anything wrong. And as a development economist, and I think a pretty good one and a pretty knowledgeable one, I would tell you that China has managed economic development better than just about any place in world history, with a lot of skill and a tremendously high saving rate and a tremendous determination to catch up from a century of impoverishment. And they've done it quite brilliantly, in fact. But in the U.S. view, they cheated, and now they have to be punished for threatening American security. So every day you read stories about how the U.S. is cutting off technology to China, telling all of us, Don't you dare buy a Huawei phone. Don't you dare use Chinese technology. Every day, new companies are listed on the so-called entity list, which is the American enemies list of foreign enterprises. And all of this is to say briefly that we're threatening a second front of war right now. Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan was an exemplar of complete irresponsibility, complete provocation, complete disrespect to another major power, complete abnegation of the One China policy after we had been asked repeatedly, do not go right now. And it's like, in my view, although I have to tell you, everybody hates me for saying it in the United States. I just got more hate mail before I walked on the stage. It's the same kind of provocations that led to the war in Ukraine. We'll talk about that. I'm supposed to say that this is an unprovoked war that started on February 24th because Putin is an irrational madman who thinks he's Peter the Great. That is the official line. This is not how the war started. This is not the background to the conflict. This is not an understanding, nor is it an approach that could possibly end this war safely. This war started when the United States decided it would move NATO to Ukraine and to Georgia. And if you look on a map, the idea quite explicitly laid out by Zbigniew Brzezinski, whom I knew and who really did not like Russia as a true Polish patriot, was that we could have NATO in Ukraine, Romania, Bulgaria, Turkey, and Georgia, thereby surrounding Russia in the Black Sea, in Sevastopol. And this is, to my mind, just the second Crimean War, because that was the idea of Palmerston and Napoleon III, and we're at it again. Boris Johnson fantasized that he was Palmerston. I don't know what the Americans think, but in any event, I'm worried about a two-front war that continues to spread, because right now one is not allowed to say one word of what I've just told you in the mainstream U.S. media. To have this debate, to discuss the origins of the crisis, to say anything other than we fully support Ukraine, which to my mind means loving them to death, to their death. And I warned the Ukrainians that at the start of this that they would become the Afghanistan of Europe. And by that I meant years and years of destruction, all in a patriotic call to battle. Austria's state treaty of 1955 is one of the great successes of diplomacy of modern history, a demonstration of how actually to make peace with a belligerent counterpart, something that has made this country remarkably successful. And I wish the lesson were understood for Ukraine, because Ukraine could have learned from Austria. Instead, Austria is often told, stop your neutrality. Please don't do that. We should really understand that a bit of mutual prudence, a bit of regard for another superpower can go a long way to preventing war, but not if you're aiming to put your peace on every spot of the map. So I'll stop there. As you can tell, I'm not enamored of U.S. foreign policy right now, but I can tell you my views are decidedly in a minority in the United States and not quite acceptable for polite company. So I apologize if I've been impolite.
When it comes to foreign policy,
all right, so that was Jeffrey Sachs, who's you can tell he's an academic by the way that he speaks. So he's thoughtful, obviously an objective to the Vietnam War back in the day, and he's still carrying a certain amount of that with him. It's not unreasonable to be anti-war. I think that's a perfectly reasonable position to take. And given a lot of the wars are manipulated, to begin with, then it's actually a very rational way to be in a world full of irrationality. I keep having conversations with people. I've got a group that meets on a Wednesday afternoon now, just for a cup of coffee and a chat, but they're lockdown skeptics, vaccine skeptics, that type of people. And there's a lot of good versus evil conversations going on in that group. It's a lot of assumptions about good versus evil. And I have a tendency to challenge assumptions about good versus evil, because everything can be explained without invoking Satan or the devil or whatever. It can all be explained by greed and lust, ultimately, which are totally human things. So if there was a need to invoke Satan, I would invoke Satan, but there isn't a need. So I don't see any reason to invoke evil when things can be explained in a very human way. It doesn't make me popular, nonetheless, but I'm not all that worried about being popular, to be honest with you. I've never been particularly popular anywhere I've been, so why change the habits of a lifetime? Anyway, let's have a look, see if there's anything else on BitChute worth playing. It's going to be a bit jumping around a little bit. It's another 10 minutes of Jeffrey Sachs. So let's try that.
That's a very pessimistic message from such a brilliant man.
Aristotle was not a
pessimist. No, you are Aristotle.
I am not a pessimist. Because what I teach is that human beings have two sides. They have the sides of selfishness and they have the sides of virtue. But the goal is to cultivate virtue. Arete in Greek. Excellence. Personal excellence. Political excellence. And what we teach as philosophers is not that human beings are intrinsically good or intrinsically evil, but they are teachable. That virtue can be cultivated, exactly what my colleague Confucius says, that people can learn virtues. Now, I also know, and I'll just say, it's every generation's responsibility to keep working for virtue, because it's never a done deal. And the greatest philosophers, my teacher, Plato, was attempted three times to be an advisor to the governor of Syracuse. He failed all three times. It's hard to be a foreign advisor, by the way. They don't listen to you, even to my teacher, Plato. But it doesn't mean you can be pessimistic. It means we have to redouble our efforts at our own virtue. Because by cultivating our own virtue, we cultivate the response in others as well. That's the idea of courtesy.
So, ladies and gentlemen, to my mind, we've been stirring the pot the whole time. And there are many complications to this story, so I could talk for hours about the details. But in 2014, the pro-Russian president was overthrown. The U.S. narrative is it was a mass public upheaval against a corrupt president. And I was there on the ground soon afterwards, and I know that the U.S. played a direct role in the overthrow. And the Russians call it a coup. So we have competing narratives, but the Russians say, look, you overthrew the president friendly to our country. We don't want you anywhere close to our borders. At the end of 2021, Putin put forward security demands to the White House. They, at the core of them was don't expand NATO. I called the White House at the end of 2021 to beg them, negotiate. We shouldn't be expanding NATO anyway. Negotiate. And I was told, no, we have an open door policy, which means that anyone that wants to join NATO can join NATO. And I said, that's crazy. This isn't a right. This is a threat to another country. This isn't about rights. This is about the effects on the neighbors. And I said, do you believe that Mexico has the right to have a military alliance with China? I don't think so. But that's what you say about Ukraine, that they have the right to have a military alliance with the United States. I said, in any event, they can ask, but it's not prudent for us to do it. Well, the White House refused any negotiations. And then there are competing stories, and I won't go into all the details, but Putin invaded on February 24th, and we've been escalating ever since. And the last week has been filled with news stories, these casual stories of will he or won't he use nuclear weapons, as if, you know, we're trying to predict the outcome of the Super Bowl. It's bizarre to me. I've just never seen anything so reckless. And I have no confidence in the U.S. government, no confidence in what we're doing to head this off, because they're dead set on doing whatever it takes. That's what they say all the time, whatever it takes to win this, for Ukraine to win this war. And since I don't think Russia's going to lose this war short of nuclear war, to my mind, we're on a recipe of continued escalation. And I'll stop with the reading. I want to read you one set of words from my favorite speech of modern times by an American president, which is President John F. Kennedy's speech on June 10, 1963. And just to give a background about this, I wrote a book about this speech because I love it so much. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev knew the world's insane. We can't go on this way. We're going to blow everything up. We need to find a way to peace. And Kennedy gave this speech on June 10, 1963 to convince Americans that it was possible to make peace with the Soviet Union, which was not a conventional view. How can you make peace with the commies? And Kennedy said, you know, we have to check our own attitudes. They're human beings. They have the same desires as we do. And they want to live in peace also. And so if the agreement is mutually satisfactory, it can be mutually observed. Very, very wise words by President Kennedy. And the whole speech is completely wonderful. And I've driven my family crazy for years by making them listen to it on multiple occasions, especially when I was writing the book. They had to listen to it 10 times at least. But in any event, Kennedy said something that I really, really want to emphasize. He said, and it's the most important statement for this moment, he said, above all, while defending our own vital interests, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish for the world. So what Kennedy is saying is you never, with a nuclear adversary, make them choose between a humiliating defeat and a nuclear war. But that's exactly what we're proposing to do right now with Putin. Not only that, we are every day Zelensky tries to humiliate Putin, not tries to solve a problem, but to humiliate Putin. Maybe, of course, he's rallying his supporters, but we get closer and closer to the precipice. I can't stand listening to Zelensky, I'm telling you, because I can understand, although I don't really understand. If I were next door to Russia, I'd have a different language, because I wouldn't want to be nuked either. But what he's doing in terms of provocation is extremely dangerous. And we're playing the game because we're saying whatever they do, that's all right. They have to win. I believe that they're the ones shelling the nuclear power plant. I'm absolutely almost sure that it's Ukraine shelling the power plant. Our papers say we don't know who's doing it. But since Russia controls the plant and Ukraine wants to win it back, I think Ukraine is shelling the nuclear power plant. I think, by the way, just to add to the discussion, that we are the ones that blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. I'm pretty sure that was a U.S. action. When I said it on television a couple of days ago, they cut me up. They took me off the air immediately because you're not allowed to say this on U.S. television. But it's pretty much conventional wisdom in other parts of the world, even by reporters that don't write it in their paper. If you talk to them privately, they say, of course it's the U.S. Who else would do it? Who else could do it? Who else had an incentive to do it? So let me stop there. It's so dangerous. We have no debate in this country, in Congress or any place else. They're not asking us to be part of this discussion, even though it's our lives on the line and our children's lives and our grandchildren's lives. New York City is extraordinarily vulnerable, I don't have to mention. And our congressmen aren't saying boo. So one thing I'd love for us to do is reach the New York delegation to just say, this is reckless. Stop it. We're in the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis this month. We don't want to replay it. And we would never have survived it had it not been for Kennedy in that position, because if it had been any of his advisors, the world would have been destroyed. But he was smart enough not to destroy the world.
All right, so that's Jeffrey Sachs again. Worth listening to, I think. Very much worth listening to. We've got about 20 minutes. Well, just under 20 minutes. I'm going to see if there's anything else on BitChute that's maybe worth playing. I'll find something that's about 15 minutes worth. Have a quick look. It's all a bit improvised, but sometimes that's the best way to do it. All right, so a little bit of Jeffrey Sachs on the Duran as well. I think this is quite recent. So let's play a little bit of that. I'll skip over the first 5 minutes or so.
In Indonesia, where probably you're able to see some of the geopolitical divisions starting to grow. So let's go straight in, as Alex says. Would you agree, first of all, that the geopolitics have been an absolute element in this crisis? And in fact, without them, it would not have the kind of crisis that we wouldn't have the kind of crisis that we have. And perhaps you can take us a little back and discuss at your leisure those aspects of the geopolitical crisis, the relations with Russia, where things began to go hideously wrong. It's a broad question, but I'm shaping it in that way so that you can discuss any point you wish and develop your views as you wish.
Well, thanks a lot. Of course, this is a geopolitical crisis, and what's at stake is how the world is going to be shaped for many years to come. And there is a view that I've wanted and held for a long time, which is that we have an open, peaceful, interconnected world. And there's another view, which is that we're divided into camps and at war with each other, whether wars on the margins of these two camps or something even dreadfully worse. And we're right now, you know, really at the a moment of truth for the world, and it's not clear which way we're going. You know, for me, you mentioned I've been a witness to this for a long time, and indeed I really was a witness to these events already 33 years ago. I was the lead advisor to Poland in its first post-communist government. I was then advisor to Gorbachev's economic team through Grigory Yavlinsky in 1990 and 91. I became advisor to Yeltsin in 1991 to 1993. And I was advisor to Leonid Kuchma, first president of independent Ukraine, in 93.
So I watched from the very beginning, and you know, I'm a softy and a bit of an idealist. So I really liked Gorbachev. Many people did not for many reasons, but I really liked Gorbachev's vision of a world that was at peace. He was really a man of peace. His fundamental point was don't shoot. And that meant the unraveling of the Soviet Union in the end. He was the one who pulled the plug on the Warsaw Pact and thought that the other side, the U.S.-led NATO side, would understand that there was an opportunity actually for a peaceful world that didn't have these two competing blocks. And I signed on to that vision. I always believed in the common European home. So people call me naive, stupid. Maybe I am. But anyway, I believe that it was the right way to go. And we obviously have seen that utterly, completely, totally, disastrously come crashing down. And so I've pondered for 30 years how we got so horribly off track. And I think it's pretty clear that you know, both sides played into this, but I utterly resent and did resent already 30 years ago that the U.S. couldn't get it through its, or U.S. leaders couldn't get it through their sometimes thick skulls that Russia didn't have to be an enemy, that it could actually just be a counterpart, even a partner on many things, and that at a time of duress at the end of the Soviet moment, it was time actually to find a path to peace. Even before that, you know, perhaps naively, I thought that Gorbachev's attempt to democratize the Soviet Union was good and should have been supported also economically. But I have to tell you, perhaps the most amazing single moment of my professional life was actually being in the Kremlin in December 1991, when Boris Yeltsin walked across the room, entered a room from a far door, walked across the room to where I was heading a small economics delegation, sat down and said, "Gentlemen," because it was all men, "gentlemen, I want to tell you the Soviet Union is finished." And he pointed to the far door and said, "I've just met with the leaders of the Soviet military, and they have agreed to the dissolution of the Soviet Union." So I heard that literally out of Yeltsin's mouth that moment, and believed that it augured peace and cooperation, and obviously that has not come to pass. So, yes, this is a geopolitical crisis. This is not a war between Russia and Ukraine mainly. This is a war between Russia and the West, if you will, especially a war between Russia and the U.S. But, you know, we use those terms. It's a war between small groups leading these countries, and especially in the U.S., the neocons who have led U.S. foreign policy basically for the last 30 years, and I think have led it disastrously wrong.
Absolutely. Now, can I just, because a lot of things there, but first of all, you talked about Eastern Europe. How is it that Eastern Europe, not just the West, has become so radicalized? Because I remember Tadeusz Mazowiecki, who was the Prime Minister of Poland. He came across to me as an extremely measured, very, you know, sensible, rational man. He did not, it seems to me, seek confrontation with Russians at that time. There was general goodwill. I mean, we also had in the Czech Republic, we had a leadership which was also willing to work with the Russians. And yet Eastern Europe has also become radicalized. It's now become extremely hostile to Russia. It's almost driving the hostility to Russia within the European Union. Is this a consequence of the divisions? Is this a consequence of NATO expansion? Is that strengthened certain elements within these societies that have sought confrontation, and is NATO expansion the root of the problem?
Yeah, these are great questions and somewhat imponderable or unknowable. Animosities between Poland and Russia are deep. They go back centuries. Poland, of course, remembers being dismembered in part by the Russian Empire, but the Russians remember Poland invading Russia in the times of trouble. So this is a conflict that goes back a very long way. But none of that makes any of this inevitable. It's all how events are shaped and perceived. And in the 1990s, there were debates everywhere about the future. So nothing was set in some hard and certain course. And in the U.S., you know, the more we learn and the more we look back, there were debates between the neocons and those who really had the view that, of course, we can have normal relations with Russia. And those debates really did center on the NATO question. We had hardliners, of course, at the end of the George W. Bush senior administration, and I ran into them in a hard way because when I advised Poland, I knew a lot about how to end a financial crisis, and I made good recommendations, and they worked. But what was fascinating for me, and I didn't understand it at the time, is every recommendation I made was accepted by the White House almost immediately. It was weird. One day I raised $1 billion for Poland, literally from morning till night, because I said so. And they said, well, do you think this will work, Mr. Sachs? And I said, this is the right thing to do. And by the end of the day, the billion had been raised for a currency stabilization fund. And I patted myself on the back. God, am I good, you know? And then 2 years later, when I made very similar recommendations for Yeltsin's government, every single one of them was rejected. And I thought, but come on, you just saw in Poland why this works, how it works, and so forth. I didn't really get at the time that I was playing economics and they were playing geopolitics. I was trying to help salvage a collapsing economy, and they were playing the board game Risk. Put your pieces on as many places on the board as you can. And I didn't really understand it at the time because I thought we were having an economics discussion and debate. But the point is that as of the mid 1990s, the original neocons on the Republican side, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, they had their counterparts on the Democratic Party side, because this isn't really partisan. This is elite U.S. politics. Madeleine Albright was a hardliner. Her vision was Central Europe's my place, my home, and Russia's the enemy. And Zbigniew Brzezinski was definitely not a lover of Russia, I would say. And so the debate ensued. And Clinton was kind of a weather vane and a political, such a political freak. He wanted to win elections, and he felt that going with NATO enlargement was the right way to go. He sided with Albright and.
All right. I'm going to stop Jeffrey Sachs there, but you get the idea. He's very, very experienced guy, very thoughtful guy. Knows what he's talking about, and he's sidelined at the moment because he's the only one who's really speaking out against war in Ukraine from that traditional kind of establishment academic side of things. Well, he's one of the only people. There's a couple of people, but that's pretty much it for now. First show of February 2023. I'll be back next week. I'll probably have some kind of show lined up next week rather than just making it up as I go along. But it depends what happens on Fridays, really. If I'm not inspired, I was hoping to be inspired in the bath this afternoon, but nothing occurred to me. But I think the Jeffrey Sachs conversation has been a good one. I certainly enjoy listening to him because he talks sense. And if you want to hear more of these types of shows where I just make them up as I go along, then have a look for my podcast, which is called Free Association. Free Association radio show. If you look on Spotify or Google Podcasts, you'll find it there. And there's a YouTube channel, which is called Technocratic Tyranny Blues. Now I changed the name of it. So if you look up Technocratic Tyranny Blues, you'll find me on YouTube and radio projects or Free Association radio show on Rumble or Locals. Will find me. But that's pretty much it for now. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you next week. Enjoy the rest of your day.
It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
There have been imaginative science fiction writers for generations.
Be invasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
I'm aware of some archaeologists that have uncovered large bones indicating giants in Virginia. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford. Join me every Thursday night in Studio A at 6 p.m. Eastern for Factor Theory Live. Find us on www.revolution.radio. Great guests and great stories.
What do you believe?
Hi, I'm Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings.